The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 12, 2009. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all on this cheery day. It was a week ago today, April 4th, was the 25th anniversary of that opening day in George Orwell's book 1984. And last Sunday, on that 25th anniversary, the Star Tribune ran an article in the Opinion Exchange, and it was titled something like, I think it was, "Imagine There's No Heaven." I guess the other line, "Imagine There's No Hell." It was about how George Orwell, and I suppose it was in honor of the 25th anniversary of 1984, which I read in when I was in high school. It seemed like this was just way in the future, you know. But now I realize that more time has passed since then than when I was looking forward at that time to 1984. And somehow 1984 doesn't seem that long ago now, but that says a little bit about the psychology of time here, I think. Looking forward, looking back, and how that changes. Anyway, the article in the Strib last week was about how George Orwell, he pondered this question, suppose there were no heaven. Orwell himself was an atheist, but he felt that if we get to this place, and it seems like for us today, most people really don't believe this anymore. And what the article in the Strib then was about was just saying, kind of attributing much of what has gone on now with the financial markets, all of this sort of thing, the banking industry, and the kind of greed that was running all of this, leading up to this. He was saying that, you know, Orwell more or less kind of predicted this sort of thing, this sort of behavior. Because if we don't believe that there's a heaven or a hell, if we don't believe that there is an afterlife, then what's going to stop us from just, living to the hilt and living for self and living for the moment? They also had they noted that apparently there's a bumper sticker out. Is it a bumper sticker? Something like that. It said something like, whoever dies with the most toys wins, you know. Maybe so. I haven't seen that bumper sticker. But if that's the case, if this is how people are looking at their life, seeing life in this way, whoever dies with the most toys wins. I mean, how bleak is that? How sad? Must we believe in the Tooth Fairy? Santa Claus? Must we believe in a fantasy story? Which for many people now, I mean, there was a time when throughout our culture, in the West anyway, the story of heaven and hell was very real. And after you die, there's this place of judgment, and you will be judged. And it will be determined whether you go to heaven or hell. And if you really believe this, you're probably going to take a little bit more care with how you live your life, perhaps. Though there's certainly plenty of evidence in the past that people still lived with a lot of cruelty and disregard for others and that sort of thing, even within a Christian culture. But of course, we can interpret the story in so many different ways, to twist it to match our own peculiar idea of what is right and wrong and good and what's God's will and all this sort of thing. But if you were to just take this away, and he felt that in our modern society, that has been more or less taken away. I mean, of course, we'll find people around who believe the story, no doubt truly believe it. Plenty of others around who might claim that they believe it, perhaps, try to live it out as though they believe it, but don't really believe it. And I've known many good Christians, say, who are good people and who try to live a good and decent life and to be considerate and kind to others and helpful and all of that sort of thing. Because, well, that's sort of the dictates of their religion. But, I don't know, do they really believe this story or not? Maybe hard to say. But do we have to believe in a story that is somewhat fantastic? It's irrational, doesn't make sense, doesn't hold up. There's really not a lot of evidence to support it. Do we have to believe in that to live a decent life? To live with kindness and consideration toward others? Well, there are many secular humanists now today who would say that, no, you don't have to believe that story, and that we can form a system of morality that is just simply based on, well, noticing what, well, returns happiness and contentment without having to resort to, well, I better be good because if I'm not, I will be condemned to hell, to be kind of, you know, whipped into this. But still, Orwell's observation that if were we to just take this away, that there isn't any condemnation, that life ultimately doesn't have any meaning. And if we just remove this from the backdrop of our minds, and so now we have a whole society of people where the majority perhaps really does, they don't, really don't believe that there's this day of judgment. You know, what will happen then? And as this article pointed out, well, I think, you know, according to this article, it seems like we've had an example of this sort of thing taking place. But this is something I think we all need to watch for, because it does seem to me, maybe most of us aren't going to go to this extreme where we will just drive the economy into the ground just for our own personal profit and gain. Maybe most of us won't really have the opportunity to even do that. But still, there'll be some of us who might do that, provided there's nothing else to, you know, stop you, such as they believe in judgment and heaven and hell and that sort of thing. Still, even for those of us who we might not carry out our activities to such an extreme, still, who perhaps have it in the backdrop of our mind that this is all meaningless, that there's really not just no heaven or hell, but there's really no real meaning to human life at all, that this is just sort of a quirk, and that we find ourselves here without any reason for it and with no real guidance as to what we should do or how we ought to live our lives. And still, we might find things then that are least meaningful for me personally or in my life. I will take these things up. But still, if in the backdrop of our mind there's just nothing, you know, to this, that is a very, you know, bleak thing to contemplate and to live with. And it seems like our modern society has walked into this situation where it's like either we believe in this fantastic story, which might give meaning and definition to our life and guidance and that sort of thing, or we are left with, well, maybe just having to make up something on our own to sustain this or to sustain ourselves, to kind of just put up with it until we finally march to the grave. And maybe that's the end of it. Or maybe not. Maybe there is something to that story. We don't, because we don't know, you see. So this is a very sad situation that we're in. And I want to ask the question, is it really that we are stuck with either we have this story that many of us find very difficult to trust, to believe, or there's nothing at all? Because I think that isn't really our situation at all. But I think for many people, that seems to be it. And so I want to just look at this a little bit. I mean, like, for example, there are things that we'll come up with, however, you know, like for example, right now, astrophysicists, going back to the early 70s anyway, oh, I forget the fellow now. He was an astrophysicist, I believe, at Cambridge, I think. Anyway, who came up with this idea of the anthropic principle? I had a little section in my first book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is, where I talked about this, but I titled it The Anthropic Fallacy. The idea that the universe is so exquisitely designed to suit us. That's why we're here. Well, this is one way of looking at this picture, that maybe we're not just left with this bleak situation here. Maybe there's something else going on here. But if this were the case, and what he points out is that if you take any number of the constants of the physical world, say gravity, for example, and you just change that ever so slightly, and I mean ever so slightly, we wouldn't be here. The galaxies wouldn't form. We just wouldn't be here. Stars wouldn't form. And these changes are very, very minute. And so if we look at that, and there's a number of these things that they've now, since I wrote that first book, a number of other things have been discovered. But just keep fitting into this. The universe just seems to be exquisitely designed so that we're here. Well, is there something else going on here then? So it isn't this fairy tale story that we have to make up, or else just, you know, we can't buy that, so now we're just stuck with just making things up. Or is there something else going on here in the world that we're not tuned into? Well, then take a look at something like that. And the anthropic principle has been used in this way to, you know, maybe show that there's something rather mysterious and strange about being here. The whole world, the whole universe seems to be tied into this in some way. That humankind has existed all these millennia and epochs of human existence here up until just very recently, being oblivious to such a principle as this. So how do we account for this? Well, it seems like there's maybe four ways then that people have tried to account for this. Unfortunately, every single one of them doesn't seem to make sense, or these isn't particularly helpful. I mean, like, for example, we could, tying in with our original story that we had, we can just simply say, well, it's because God made it this way. Just a nice, perfect design. Well, of course. And isn't God perfect? And, you know, wouldn't God just make this perfect universe just for us and that sort of thing? Well, yeah, I mean, we can say this, but that's just, once again, just kind of reaching for, I mean, we could say anything, I suppose, and make up any kind of justification for this. But that's a bit of a stretch to say, well, yeah, that's the answer then, so let's embrace that. When there's nothing there to support that, and it doesn't really explain anything. It is just sort of, once again, we're willing to go back and, you know, pick up a story of Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or something, and this will cover it for us. So for many, that's not a very adequate explanation for this situation. And there's others who would just simply say, well, it's just a coincidence. A coincidence, but a coincidence. What kind of a coincidence is it that if, I mean, some of these numbers, if they were just tweaked, like one, if you take a zero and put a decimal point and then string out 125 zeros and then you put in a one, do you realize how small that number? I mean, if you just tweaked it that much, the universe wouldn't have happened. At least not the universe that would support us. That's a coincidence? You think about it. What's 0.1? Well, we know that that's 1/10. And 0.01, that's 1/100. 1/10 down to 1/100. 0.001, 1/1000. Put in 5 zeros, 1,000,000. You put in 8 zeros, 1,000,000,000. Put in 11 zeros, 1,000,000,000,000. What is the difference between 1,000,000,000, 1,000,000,000, and 1,000,000,000,000? We throw around these numbers all the time with our, now we talk about the economy in terms of trillions of dollars. Most of us have no idea. Of course, 1,000,000,000,000 is 1,000,000,000,000. 1,000,000,000,000 is 1,000,000,000,000. the most graphic example I've ever seen to help us kind of get a sense of how big these numbers are. Say you win some kind of peculiar lottery that, you know, so you win $1 million, but they're going to pay you by handing you a dollar bill every second. How long would it take them to pay off that $1 million? Well, I'll tell you, it would take about 11 days. You would finally have your million. But if you won $1 billion that way, they would be handing you a dollar bill every second for over 32 years. That's the difference between a million and a billion. And what about a trillion? How long would that take? Well, you're not going to live it out. It would take 32,000 years for them to pay off $1 trillion that way. And a trillionth then would be $1 bill out of that string of dollar bills coming one per second for 32,000 years. One of those, the magic one, would be one in a trillion. That's just what 11 zeros, point 11 zeros and then a one. We're talking about something that goes to point 125 zeros and then a one. Incomprehensibly small. And cosmologists, astrophysicists, they say if we just tweak the number in that decimal place, just by one, we wouldn't be here. And there are a number of things like this, not just with gravity, but there's any number of things where they've noticed this sort of thing. So to say a coincidence, it's just a coincidence that the universe is set up this way, somehow that doesn't seem to ring true. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch. So then other physicists noting this, they point out, well, we have these other kind of ideas, an idea that comes from quantum mechanics, where it's called other worlds theory, or multiple worlds theory, where there's just virtually an infinite number of universes. And so if there's an infinite number of universes, certainly there'll be one at least that will be like ours. Well, okay, that's... But doesn't that also seem a little strange? Where's the support for? There's virtually no evidence that there's another universe. And what do we even mean by another universe? Just one other universe, let alone an infinite number. So once again, we're, you know, with all of these, we're kind of just going right back to believing in the Easter Bunny or something. It's just, you know, these are not explanations for a very real observation that physicists and astronomers have made. Well, then there's the favored explanation, finally. But I hope to show that this is about as vacuous as the others, I think. And that is that basically this is what I call the anthropic fallacy. This is the anthropic principle, but I would call it the anthropic fallacy, that it is that we have created this universe. It is somehow a principle that is based on the fact that we're here and that life has generated this. And in particular, human life has generated this. But once again, I would find, as one who studies the Dharma in this way that we follow here, and having an understanding of the Buddha's insight, and realizing that we don't actually find a self here, if we look very carefully at this experience, so it is, we can't base it then on some particular life form, or some particular object of some kind, a person, or even a collection of people, or even this biomass itself. That seems a bit of a stretch as well. So it seems to me that given, if these are the only four explanations that we have for this very peculiar observation that has, since it was first made back in the 70s, it has only gotten stronger and stronger as time has gone on. More and more supporting evidence to the strangeness, the apparent uniqueness of the universe that we live in, that would allow us to be here. So it's something worth contemplating, I think. Well, then how would we explain this? And I think that this is where we go wrong, is that this shows us something about our grasping mind, and it is our grasping mind that forms me, and it forms you, it forms this world, it forms this place. It is this grasping mind alone, but this mind doesn't belong to any one or any form thing there within this world. It is just mind itself. That this is the world. This is the universe. It doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere. That the things that we see and hear here, they don't construct anything. They don't make the universe. They don't produce this world. This is the world itself. And the reason that we can get out to these exquisitely fine numbers like 0.125 zeros and then a one, I think we could just keep stringing the zeros endlessly. Because were we to see directly what the experience of this moment is, one of the things that comes with awakening, as the Buddha realized and pointed out, is that it cannot be some other way. The universe, the world as we find it here, is the only way it could possibly be. There aren't any other possibilities for this. And how is it exactly? Well, it isn't really any particular way. That's the reason we can't get hold of anything here. Any explanations, not the Easter Bunny story or the Anthropic principle or whatever you want to put there. You will always come, and we can find these highly refined and exquisitely beautiful and interesting conundrums here, and just how rare it seems that we have anything here at all. And no matter what we put there, in terms of our going after now some explanation for this, we will always end up with some aspect of it will show itself to be inadequate, contradictory, a coincidence so large that it's worthless to even contemplate it in any serious manner whatsoever. This is what we will find endlessly. But as long as we as human beings are continuously reaching for something to support what? To support this sense of self, this sense of ego here, thinking that the universe really is this way with me in it. Here I am, and now I need to come up with some explanation for this, some way to support this and to make this real. Either that or we never even contemplate that. We just simply walk around with this sense of self. And then sometimes we run into these things where it seems like life is just so utterly meaningless. And maybe some of us commit suicide. Others of us just despair. Others of us just become greedy. Our response to this could be endless, you know, just where we just tune it out and we live in kind of a fearful cage of just trying to make ourselves happy and pleased all the time. We do this because, you know, we'll construct things of this sort because we actually can't find something that will clearly support this notion, this incredible and intense belief that we have. In self, in substance, in existence, in being. It's very difficult for us to just look at the world, to look at experience directly and to realize it is mind. It is just this, it is immediate, it is direct, it isn't anything in particular. That the things that are appear here without any kind of substance or form or own being, self-nature, as a particular thing. This is what we see. This is what we experience all the time. But our grasping mind always insists on putting something behind that. Awakening, what the Buddha realized finally, is that it is just this. As he said, as a man walking along steps on a rope but believes that he stepped upon a poisonous serpent and then trembles in fear and horror. You know, this horrible circumstance to find himself in. But then looks down, in other words, looks, sees, and realizes that it is only a rope. So it is, he said, one day I realized that what I was calling I cannot be found, it is not within this experience. And immediately there is release. from this horrible, vexing situation that we as human beings with our wonderful minds find ourselves in, because we have this incredible ability to construct something there for ourselves, thinking it is real. So to see that, to see through this illusion, to see it for what it is the release. Bear in mind that, you know, our normal mind thinking that, well, then this is an illusion, we must be talking about some kind of nothingness. And of course, we call this emptiness, maybe that's not such a good word, the word is shunyata. This just means insubstantiality. But it doesn't mean nothingness. We are talking about the world as we find it, as we see it, hear it, feel it, think it. This is what we awaken to. This is what there is to awaken to. But there isn't something behind that that we can grasp or hold to. Were we to see that at long last, we would realize what it is that the Buddha and these great enlightened teachers of the past have been pointing out all along. And we'd be spared a great deal of anxiety and worry. And then when we discover, as we'll discover other very strange, exciting maybe in some ways to ponder, these very strange things that we'll discover about the universe and about the world here. And then we will want to put something there to explain it. When in one flash of insight we can realize the situation that we're in right from the very start, and it is without need of an explanation. Were we to see that this, thus, whatever we experience directly all the time, is mind, or maybe we shouldn't even put any word to it at all, but it is just thus. This is the freedom, the liberation that the Buddha spoke of. And it is something quite different from anything else that we would want to put there. And if you notice carefully, the Buddha, Nagarjuna, these Gudogan, these guys, they don't actually put something there. Well, they say mind. Dogen, a few weeks ago, I talked about where Dogen said that, I tell you, plants, trees, tiles, pebbles are mind. And it startles our ears. We don't believe it. We just, you know, this just seems too incredible. What do you even mean by that? Yeah. But it's just us. It isn't like it's something mysterious or strange. It is what is immediately experienced. But we don't find an experiencer. We don't find any substantiality behind what it is that's experienced. But here it is. This is the world. This is reality. And we already know this. We already experience this directly. But for our grasping mind, our jabbering mind, our mind and want and need of some kind of explanation, where we get sidetracked, we miss it entirely. We miss the liberation. We miss the freedom of realizing just this. Okay, well, maybe I've said enough on this morning, but do you have any questions about anything I said there? Yes, Mark.
Well, I'll start with the comments. It seems to me that whether you're dealing with the number point and 125 zeros and a one, or humanity, is that in every case you're dealing with a limited set. Now, my question would be, is dukkha simply attachment to the limited set?
Yeah. Right. Anything else? I thought I saw it. Yeah, Andrew.
I just had something that kind of came into my head as you were speaking. There was a really neat book I read a while back ago called The Accidental Buddhist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the very last chapter, in the very last page, the author closes by saying something like, if there is a God, then I would do well to be mindful and sit upright. And if there's not a God, I'll do well to be mindful and sit upright. And he said something like, how perfectly Buddhist. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. That kind of similar to what you were saying this morning.
Mm-hmm. And then that's all we need to do is just to wake up. So just sit upright, be mindful. Be mindful of even that jabbering mind. And don't entertain that. Let it jabber if it must. But don't take it seriously. It's just jabbering. And the jabbering gets in the way of your true understanding, which is already there. You already have the true understanding, but because we jabber and we're paying all kinds of attention to that, we miss it. But yes, well, so just sit upright, be mindful, and at some point we'll realize what we're doing, and we can stop, or we can at least not be caught by it. David, you had some?
An interesting, different definition of belief that I've been experiencing is not so much an idea, but what one chooses to place value in. The essays on National Public Radio, This I Believe, are typically that kind of thing. You know, one aspect of life that I place value in, the one I heard today, was a change from believing in striving to succeed individually in the American dream, giving up on that and believing in neighborliness and doing things together. So it's, you know, it kind of goes along with your talk. Your talk vastly outpaces it, or it goes to further links, but just a change of belief. But as you were speaking, I realized that I believe in the Easter Bunny, because later today I will hide Easter eggs for children to follow.
Yeah. Well, we can hide the eggs without believing in the Easter Bunny. Or even believing in the eggs. Yeah. But and we can also be neighborly without believing in neighborliness. When we see the world as a whole, and not as something, you know, set apart from me, then we will be neighborly, quite naturally, without having to think about it, or to even preach it, or to say this is a good idea, we should all follow this. Of course, yeah, that would one be, but that's only going to cause trouble. So again, I would say we can actually live without belief, without holding to beliefs. And beliefs are an idea, and neighborliness, that's still an idea. And if we hold it too tightly, it's going to start causing trouble. So that's what I'm pointing out. But that was a good observation, thank you. And it's okay to believe in the Easter Bunny. As long as you know what you're, you know, that it's just an idea you're holding temporarily. But I also say, too, just be careful in dealing with children. Like, we'll tell them about the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus, something like this, and then they grow up. Sooner or later, they realize, well, there's really no Easter Bunny as such, and there's just no Santa Claus. But these grown-ups, they all told me. There was this, and they were lying to me, you see. Now, this is going to cause trouble, you see. Yeah, okay, well, then there's no Santa Claus, so then there's no Easter Bunny, and there's no Tooth Fairy. Okay, and there's no resurrection. So we can go on from this all the way up to where there's no God, you know.
Children know who life is.
Oh, they do. Okay. Well, that's good. So, and, yeah. So we can still have enjoyment with the children and hiding the Easter eggs without making them think that there has to be an Easter Bunny to pull this thing off. No, no. We can all just have fun doing that. But we should be careful when we're dealing with children, because so easily they'll form things. Of course, we all do. But children have a lot less defense than we do, a lot less experience and critical judgment and that sort of thing. So we need to be careful, and that's all. Yeah, Jay?
Your explanation about how unique, how the possibility of the world being what it is, 125 zeros, multiplied by one. It's something that, as a child, I always felt there was something very mysterious. This is pretty amazing that there is anything that exists at all on this. And it bothered me a lot, and I tried to look at some of the answers you looked at. And I finally said, there's no way I'll ever know the answer to this. But if you give up that, I need to know the answer, there is sort of a a certain joy or a mystery to the just the fact we're here.
If you completely give up on wanting an answer to that, you will know. And you do know right now. It is because we want to answer that we find it mysterious. Yeah, and if we were to not go for that, but just to see immediately what is being experienced here, already the knowing is already in that. And it is not something we need to figure out or to get. But it is always our desire to try to answer that, and then we'll be left with that sense of mystery, at least when it comes to these kinds of questions. Because there's no back end to it. Like I said, we can continue to string those zeros out. We're not going to get to the end of this.
I'm not sure of the word. The word knowing. I think I'm grasping onto that word, saying if I know, then I really know, and that's probably getting me in trouble.
Yeah, that's not knowing.
No. So
yeah, that's having an idea. That's like belief.
Yeah.
See, and because that's what belief is a grasping of an idea. But it happens to be we're grasping an idea that we think is true. That's what we call belief. But then there's just plain grasping at ideas. As well, we may or may not believe this or that idea. We have an idea of the Easter Bunny. Most of us probably don't believe it, whatever that would be even. But when we get hold of it, where we think that knowing is somehow forming finally an idea about something. But actually, that's not knowing. That's completely indistinguishable from belief. And belief is always without a bottom. It's always rocky. There's always contradiction in it. And there'll always be problems. So if we continuously keep setting our life into some kind of a storyline to explain anything, and that's what we're trying to rest on, we will always be uneasy. Because underneath it all, we do know. And we also know that it's not true. Though some of us are, I don't know, fortunate or unfortunate enough to so heavily get loaded up with the belief and we really buy it that we don't notice that disturbance. But still, it is kind of like living out your life then as a little child, still believing in the fantastic story, as opposed to going into that uncomfortable space where you realize the story is, you know, that's not going to hold up. And now we think we must. Like I say, some people are driven to despair at this point. But if we just keep going and just learn to, well, as we were saying, just to, you know, sit upright, to settle down here and to be mindful, pay attention, just be here with us, we will discover that we already know. And the need to answer any of this is gone. We don't need to answer any of it. We can't. And we can know that. We can realize that. So I don't know if that made sense or not.
It makes sense. It's just that final step. I understand that the need to know is impossible. But I still want to know.
the need, yes, but I'm saying you can know.
Yeah.
And you do know. And you already know, Jay.
Yeah.
We all do. But it's because we keep reaching for the idea. We keep thinking knowledge has to be, I got to get some idea about this. But I'm saying that's not knowing. But that's what we keep wanting to do. You maybe even want to get an idea about what I just said there. But that's worthless, even if you got an idea. That's not. This is precisely why I pointed this out a number of times. Why Suzuki Roshi, for example, at one point where he said, "When my talk is over, your listening is over. There's no need to remember what I said." How absurd! You know, I mean, why would you go to a talk if you know? But it is like that because if you remember, then you hold on to some ideas. If you grasp those, you're thinking, I understand. But the true knowing that we want to uncover here isn't something like that. It isn't holding an idea. So never mind. You might grasp some ideas. Say from this talk I gave today, it might give you some new thoughts to think about and grasp. And sometimes they might be interesting or disturbing, or it could be any number of things there. And that's all fine. Just let it be. But in the end, you know, what I'm interested in here is to help you at some point to just see directly what this is. And there's where you'll find the knowing. It's not something I can tell you. It's not something my teacher could tell me. It's not something like that at all. And it is also something not apart from you right now, or something separate from your mind. It's already immediate and direct, and that is the knowing. We are experiencing continuously reality, and we know it. It's just that we jabber to ourselves. Unfortunately, our species is such that we have these incredible minds where we can overlay the direct experience with so much thought, and where we can wrap the whole world in just an abstract frame like this, and we get lost in that, thinking that here's where we're going to find reality. And that's all very functional. There's nothing wrong with this. It's wonderful. It's great. But I guess what I'm trying to say here is that we allow our minds, these incredible human minds that we have, to abuse us, in a sense, and to deceive us and to fool us. And rather than to use them as the wonderful instruments that they are to enrich our lives in so many different ways, but we end up getting enslaved by that and taken away by that. And we don't realize that the actual knowing, which is what we try to seek through all of that grasping, that intellection, is already just sitting there all along. We don't turn our attention to that. That is just, once again, and just to sit upright, to pay attention, to be here, to be mindful, to be present. That's why in our practice we cultivate that. Because at some point, finally, we'll wake up. And we'll wake up to what it is that we've known all along. It won't be like something new or dazzling or startling. It's just like something that's been known all along, but we just haven't paid attention to. So this isn't like knowing like getting an idea. This is knowing like letting the ideas drop away, or not having to pick them up or use them to somehow get the right idea. There isn't any right idea. All ideas are delusional. But some are very useful. You've even made that observation yourself many times. So we just have to trust this. And also to realize, too, that in sitting down in meditation to make this effort to carry out sanzen, as Dogen would put it, to carry this out properly, isn't to gain anything. And it isn't, as we might think, trying to become enlightened, or we're trying to become relaxed or settled or whatever. That's not what this is about at all. But if we continue to practice in the way that we think we're doing something like that, or I'll do this long enough and then eventually I'll understand, as we continue to carry on in that way, you can carry this out for eons and nothing's ever going to happen. For as many eons as there are grains of sands in the Ganges, and nothing will happen out of it. However, in just going ahead and doing that, at some point you might realize that. And then you can stop. So even though we first sit down, all of us, me too, we come to this with the wrong kind of notions and ideas. We think we know what this is, or at least we think we can get some ideas about it and how it is and that sort of thing. But all of that in the end is worthless. Still, just go ahead, do this. Because in doing this, finally you can realize what it is that you're doing. But what it is that you wake up to is something that's been here all along. And it's just that we've been preoccupied with other things. So there's something very simple here. But as we continue to keep playing around with the other things, we can also get very discouraged about this matter of just sitting. Because we think, well, that isn't netting me anything. Well, yeah, but nobody ever promised you that it would. There's just the wrong game plan there. It's the wrong idea about what this is. But we'll use that wrong idea to judge it badly. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to waste my time just sitting there day after day, and you're not going to get anything anyway. And then, you know, it should be. We just don't realize what this is yet. But I would say, even though we have the wrong idea, go ahead and practice with the wrong idea. But I would say, see if you can just not hang on to that so tightly, and just come back to this and come back to this, because there's something here that is subtle and exquisite, and it's not something that you can form an idea about ahead of time and then go get it. It's just something else altogether. No matter, you know, we can contemplate all of these peculiar arrangements in the universe, and well, it just seems to be just so. How could that be? And we can play around with this forever. Or we can finally wake up and understand why exactly, without having a theory about it, or an argument that will have holes in it. They always do. Nagarjuna proves that. So we're talking about something else altogether different from our ordinary way. We have to at least have some inkling of that. It might then give us just the whatever it is we need to just take this up and do it. But we have to eventually learn to just do it, and with no reason for it whatsoever. Like right now, I mean, I've been sitting now, not steadily, but I've been at this practice over 40 years now, and long ago now, I realized where I just dropped any idea. I mean, I don't know why. The last 30 years, I have not had any idea or justification for sitting meditation. I honestly do not. And so people want to say, well, why should I sit? I have no reason for why you should sit, really. But I would say, go ahead. If you really understand what the sitting is, nothing would keep you from it. But, well, then, well, what is that? What is it? But there isn't any real reason. It isn't about getting something. You sit now, you will get something. The awakened tell you that's completely false. We don't get anything for sitting. Well, then why do you sit? You see, but we keep it in that grasping mind, and we keep wanting some justification or explanation for this. And we don't have a clue at first that this is just completely the whole wrong ballpark, the wrong game plan, the wrong everything. This isn't what they're doing. This isn't what they've discovered. You see? But still, if we try to carry out our practice in some way and we have some ideas about it, you are going to have trouble with it. But eventually you might learn to just, okay, drop it. Just drop the ideas. See if you can just continue to practice now. And it probably won't take too long after that that the understanding will come. But that's not something I can teach you or tell you or hand it to you. I can only encourage you to just stay with this and to watch your mind. Okay, well, it is getting a little late. I thought was there another hand over here? Or you? Okay. Is it a brief one? You always get me in trouble in these long, drawn-out things. So, see if I can answer you in one word, anyway.
Speaking of the book 1984, where did this idea come from that democracy is synonymous with capitalism?
Well, there we go. Yeah, well, that's maybe a sidetrack, but that's an interesting thought. Yeah, that capitalism and democracy go hand in hand. Not very well. Democracy works much better with socialism, not communism. That's a little bit different again. So to have a social democracy makes sense. Because in capitalism, what happens? Power keeps going into those who have the power and the money and the influence, and it keeps going in. And so now they can even control the electorate and the information and all that. Yeah, it doesn't work very well. So it's questionable whether or not we truly do have a democracy here. Yeah, but of course we also have been taught and enculturated to think, well, anytime you mention socialism, oh my gosh, oh, what socialism, isn't that very close to atheism? Things like that, so we've been taught to kind of, no, I don't want socialism, my gosh. So there we are. But as an individual, I would say, just watch your mind. And don't judge the others, but realize when you're being sold something, just see for yourself. And sit upright and pay attention. Be aware, that's all. And now we all are living in a society. We're living with others. What's the best way to conduct your life in such a way that you can remain sane and present and help others to find that as well? That's what we need to do. Okay, well, we probably should end it here. But thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.